ตัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอปาฤฏฐาเตสังอมัตถสทาวราเยโสตวันทาบะมุจันทุสัทธัง
So this has been a very wonderful day to see so many of you that I've known for so many years assemble in one place. This especially this place. And of course, this is my 28th year living in the UK. So you think back of when you.First came to, I first arrived in London and moving into a new life from spending 10 years in Thailand, not knowing what to expect. And then when you don't know what to expect, the future then holds any possibility from, you know, the most fantastic success to the most miserable failure. But fortunately, the power of Ajahn Chah's teaching was this is teaching of my man. This nothing is known, you can't know. It's the don't know, rather than, you know, believing in having always goals that you create in the present to achieve in the future. Reflection, ability to be aware and be present, puts you in the state of non-attachment.To any idea about the future or any obsession around the past. So I remember when we came to Chithurst in 1979, some people thought we were, you know, it was a crazy thing to do. We didn't know any Buddhists living in West Sussex. And the house was an absolute wreck, you know, the Chithurst house. So, but it seemed like definitely the don't know was the only way one could deal with this mystery. And of course, 25 years have passed here at Chithurst, and the result, of course, is very pleasing.And it is a mystery. We like certitude and want guarantees about our future, and want to know if, you know, have certificates. Because we like, you know, we most people want to know everything. They want to feel they know everything, even if it is impossible. You know, a demagogue or some.A charismatic guru can make you feel certain and give you assurance, and that makes us feel good, or gives a sense of security. And then when things change and it doesn't work out that way, then we feel very distressed and upset and angry, and end up burning the guru. So the future is the unknown. It's always a kind of mantra in my mind, because this was drummed into me. And of course, it's a reality. You know, when you really observe and the way things are in this present moment, you know, you can observe and know it's like this.But even the next hour, or the next half an hour, or the next day, or next month, these are, we don't know, it's uncertain. And that very insecurity, that sense of insecurity, not knowing, uncertainty, is what we meditate on. We open ourselves to uncertainty, not knowing, rather than trying to have an answer for every question and a solution for every problem. Of course, in the worldly life, that sounds like being irresponsible, because it's always making plans for the future and having all the strings tied in neat knots and trying to give this, trying to create this sense of security. Our society very much longs for that. We can see it in with the elections coming up here and in the United States. Politicians want to offer certitude, make people feel, if you elect me, then I can fulfill all your wishes. But the reality, whether it's in politics or religion or this personal experience, is this uncertainty. So, like mindfulness, then, is a way to be able to recognize that, to know. It's not a kind of blind resignation to not knowing. It's not a negative state. It's a very alive state of openness and attention to the present, and rather than trying to always project into the present something that we want to hold on to and believe in. And of course, the most human beings find this quite difficult, because we're conditioned in another way. We're conditioned to always create, to project, to make everything more than what it is, to make what is simple complicated. So meditation is the ultimate simplicity. And then we think if it's simple, then it's easy. But it's not easy. because it's not easy in itself, but it's because we're not simple. If you say somebody's simple, it's usually an insult, isn't it? But to me, if somebody says, "You're so simple, Ajahn," it would be a great compliment. And say, "You're very complicated, Ajahn Sumedho." I don't know if I like that. And yet, on the ego level, being a complicated, fascinating personality can be quite attractive. I remember when I was a layman, when I was a university student, I didn't want to be simple. I wanted to be kind of fascinating and complicated and neurotic. Drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes and worrying about everything you could possibly worry about and criticize everything around you. But in life here, in my monastic life here in Britain, has been a very positive experience. Coming from a rather secure situation in Thailand, with a very good teacher, Lungpa Cha, and where you've got a society that's Buddhist, and you've got all the conditions there to support monastic discipline in a certain way, and you've got so many options. If you don't particularly like one monastery, you've got many, many others to go to. And then finding yourself here in England and not having all that security. And I remember moving here to Chithurst in 1979, and there were so many problems facing us, because the house was a derelict house, and it really, we moved into the house. We had no other place to live, so we moved into this derelict house, which really, could have been quite dangerous, because parts of it were falling down. And it was literally, riddled with dry rot. And so, and then there was this movement in this area to try to force us out. to try to get rid of us, because we are not exactly the kind of people the general population of this area would like to have as neighbors. And so, because we do look a bit strange, we don't quite fit into the stereotype of what a good English countryside, beautiful English countryside, what you want to see present there. You know, shaven-headed, saffron-robed monks and nuns. And so there is this fear that we would be forced out of here. And remember, being involved in this, in these discussions, and the worries about it. So then this sense of uncertainty, you know, I began to really contemplate that how much I wanted certainty. I wanted to have everything sure. I wanted to know, this is our property. This is our monastery. We can stay here. This is our place. And this, I could contemplate this demand of me that I was making. I want this to be our place legally and in every way. And I want the council to agree to it. And I want this and I want that. And maybe I'm not going to get it. Maybe they'll throw us out. And then this reflection on uncertainty. Then immediately I began to stop creating this problem, you know, whether we could stay or couldn't stay, or what seemed to be irrelevant. The practice was always being present here and now, and allowing for uncertainty and welcoming it rather than just passively, kind of resigning yourself to it. But it was a very active acceptance of uncertainty. So mindfulness then isn't a passive negative state of just letting things happen because there's nothing you can do about it. That I would call resignation to fate, and which is a rather negative way of looking at it. But mindfulness is attention, full attention to the present. So like mountain climbing is demands full attention to the present, doesn't it, Andrew? this is sometimes dangerous sports and situations. We have to be fully present, and we become fully alive. You know, in rather intense situations where there's life threatening possibilities, and you just naturally kind of awaken and be fully present because of the life force, the desire to stay alive and to protect your life. And yet in modern life we most of our life isn't a matter of life and death, isn't we aren't living in situations where there's a continuous danger, so we can sink into an endless misery of wanting and complaining and desiring something we don't have and complaining about what we have. And this very habit of the mind, and this is, I think, most of us coming from a kind of middle-class background in the States, which was this kind of social conditioning was very much based on, you know, complaining about things and keeping up with the Joneses, looking at what the neighbors have and then envying and wanting to you know, keep up with them or get ahead. So the materialism of the West was one that perpetuated this sense of always having to strive and work hard to keep up appearances, to make you feel safe and secure and acceptable in the society. The thing that I really liked about living in Thailand as a Buddhist monk was you kind of stepped out of that whole realm of social class structures or positioning in a society. And being a foreigner in Thailand. You're in a country that's very homogeneous. It's most of the Thai population are Thai and Theravadan Buddhists, and their minorities, like ethnic minorities, religious minorities, are very small. And so it does have this homogeneity and this strong culture based on and very much integrated with Buddhism. And yet, coming into the monastic system in Thailand, I found a sense of being, something, being at ease within it, being a part of it. Even though I was an obvious foreigner, at first I couldn't even understand what they were talking about, couldn't understand the language. I didn't understand all the customs and all the etiquettes and so forth. But yet, basically, there was this intuitive sense of, and this emphasis on awareness, being here and now, the way it is. Now, at first, when Lungpa Cha used to talk about the way it is, I wanted him to explain the way it is. He says, well, it's the way it is. What do you mean by that? Because this is how my mind worked, and the way it is was kind of meaningless. Because my language was always used to define things or analyze things. The way I learned to use language, English language, was always to think about things and judge and criticize and compare and evaluate. And yet in the monastery, Lungpa Cha wasn't doing that. He was using language to point at things, to awaken you, so that the Buddha's teachings were not kind of, beautifully structured analytical teachings that one would grasp, but the way he taught was very much getting you to look at the reality of this moment and taking the various Buddhist teachings not as something to try to interpret life through, but pointers at reality. So much of the basic teaching was on this not knowing. This emphasis in Vipassana meditation on impermanence and Nietzsche. Seeing the impermanent nature of sensory experience, of mental experience, of the material world. Noticing change is something quite obvious. Change isn't just an intellectual concept, an abstract idea. It's happening right now, so you don't need to look it up in the dictionary and memorize the definition, just awaken to the reality of change. So that was quite an insight, because this was my way of dealing with the thinking process and use of language was I'd never really looked at it in that way, never thought of using terminologies or concepts for reflection, for contemplation, for awakening. But because the habit was so strong, because that's the way we're, I was educated and the way you're brought up, and so what, I was very attached to my ideas, my opinions and views. I had, ideals, very high-minded ideals. I was quite altruistic person. So I'd feel sometimes very upset or very disgruntled or confused when monastic life didn't live up to my ideals of how Buddhist monks should be or Buddhist monasteries should be. So then Ajahn Chah is very good at, getting me to see, this is the way it is. And I think, but it shouldn't be like this. It should be, And he wouldn't. I could never intimidate him. I could never kind of wind him up to do something that I felt should be done. But he would actually, be able to point at that which was upset in myself, that desire to change something, to get something I don't have, or to get rid of the things that we have that I don't like. And so this was how he used the essential teaching of the Buddha when he called the Four Noble Truths. These Four Noble Truths were not just intellectual studies and rationalizations, but they were pointing at the reality of this moment. And how to tune into it, how to look at it, ways of looking at this moment that I would never have discovered on my own in any way. So that the Buddha's teaching was really a tool, a very helpful tool that was made available to me, which I began to learn how to use for awakening, for awareness, for understanding. So by the time I came to live in England, I'd had 11 years actually of practice. And Ajahn Chah was very much into the practice. And this word practice was the word you hear it all the time. In Thai they say Batibat, which is a Pali word, Batibata, which means practice. And when I was learning Thai, I'd always hear Batibat, 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 and then I began to hear this word over and over, and then of course translating it into the English word practice. And this is what appealed to me was. Well, I wasn't interested in trying to know more about Buddhism, and trying to figure it out and learn all about the different schools and varieties and its history and all that, even though I found that interesting. It wasn't that I didn't find that interesting, but I knew that I could learn all that and still be just as miserable. And I could read about the Four Noble Truths and be inspired by it and still be just as miserable. So then the Batibat was obviously the way. Put it into practice, make it work. And that was through awareness, not through grasping or through just emulating Ajahn Chah, but through really taking that, learning what awakeness is. Awakeness is alive. It's where you're really with the present, and it's fully conscious, and it's not clouded with a lot of negative perceptions. And when these negative perceptions arise and so forth, as you trust in this awakeness, this awareness, then more and more you become aware of how things move through your consciousness, your habit patterns, the way you tend to think, or your emotional habits become conscious. When you allow these conditions into consciousness, and you're aware, because in that allowing things to be what they are, then they arise and they cease, and that's through our conscious experience in the present. So we're aware of the arising and the cessation. So, in exploring this and in practicing this, I found at first, I would have insight, and then I'd easily fall back into the old habits, because the old habits of my personality, my emotional habits and views and opinions were much stronger than my awareness. So I remember, feeling when I was, ordained and I was having insight into Dhamma, sometimes feeling despair because, I would have insight, I could see, and then I'd be fall right back into the old patterns of thinking and negative thinking or complaining or feeling sorry for myself or whatever, getting angry or upset over little things. But then through that pursuit of this Ngpo Chao's emphasis on practice, 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 And then the way, the function of monastic life, the way monastic life is, the structure and its lifestyle gives one, you know, this support for awareness. So, say a Buddhist monastery is really a place where awareness is. It doesn't mean that awareness isn't possible outside the monastery, but this is the real purpose of this monastery, chitters. Is to develop, to recognize awareness, to appreciate it, to develop it, to trust it. And so, so that, say, a monastery like this is its purpose, its function in this society here in England. But yet we can forget ourselves easily in a monastery and get carried away with so many personal things, personal views and opinions, and, you know, the way monks and nuns and people live together. We affect each other personally quite a lot. So there's a lot of personal conflict. And that personal conflict can become the kind of the obsession of the mind, trying to resolve all the personal conflicts, trying to iron out all the wrinkles, trying to make everybody happy, everybody, you know, trying to... that we've got this idea that Buddhist monasteries should be peaceful and compassionate places where we can live and feel safe and secure, and we can, once we feel safe and secure and accepted and loved, then we can really practice. But I don't see it like that, because it's a moral base. You know, there's a standard of moral commitment within the monastic code and within the lay people's code. And this morality is a commitment to nonviolence, to honesty, to being responsible on the level of action and speech. So this is the basis that we can at least agree to. You know, whether we can make it happen like that all the time, but this is the agreement that human beings can make. We can agree on moral principles, moral precepts, that we're going to respect these precepts in order that we can live together in a way that we can deal with the personal problems and difficulties between on the personal level. But in a monastery, then what I've always tried to do is keep this practice as the emphasis. That our life within the monastic system isn't just we're not trying to live a lifestyle for our own kind of happiness and benefit and that, but for awareness, how to use the monastic form, the monastery itself, for awareness. How to use this Dharma hall for awareness, this monastery, Chitters Buddhist Monastery, for awareness, so that we can, you know, rather than just getting attached and clinging or getting caught up in liking or disliking or being critical of it and whatnot, really using our time here, our experience here, for observing that. Because like any place in any community, it goes through various cycles of inspiration, desperation, everybody's in harmony and everybody out of harmony. Things, you can't sustain it. You can't create a monastery or a society or a family or anything where it's just harmonious all the time and everybody loves each other endlessly, you know, without any disruption. I mean, that's an ideal. That's the ideal. But that's not the way things are. So, noticing, one time I remember at Wat Pa Pong, Lungpa Cha's monastery in Thailand, you know, there was a monk there that I thought was a real troublemaker. And he had a very loud voice, and he was junior to me, but he was always He always had opinions and views, and wherever he went, you'd hear his voice in the eating hall. Always his voice, and he was always talking to everybody. And he had strong views and opinions, and he didn't like Westerners very well. So I kept hearing the word for what they call foreigners in Thai, Farang. So I kept hearing this word, Farang, but it was used in a like contempt, in a way of contempt, you know. And so I began to feel really indignant, you know, this Farang. And so I thought, this, you know, Ajahn Chah shouldn't allow this monk in this monastery. I'm going to get very righteous. I'm quite capable of being very righteous. And so, I began to think about him a lot and develop increasing amount of aversion to this monk. At the time, there was an increasing amount of Westerners coming to the monastery. And I was the most senior Western bhikkhu. So I had to take responsibility for all of them. And some of them were, you know, a lot of hippies at that time were drifting into Wat Pa Po. And these were, you know, Westerners from Europe, America, Australia, kind of drifting around and enter a Buddhist monastery that's very kind of orthodox and strict in its discipline. And Thai monastic discipline and Thai monastic etiquette is very refined, quite, you know, they have a very high level of etiquette in their monasteries. And of course, most of us, most Westerners, especially the hippie generation, totally lack that sense of good manners and etiquette. So I was supposed to kind of inform them, and I resented this, you know, having to go around correcting them and telling them how to do things. And then when I kept hearing this monk using the word Farang in such a contemptuous way, I went on a campaign against him. Which I regret. But anyway, the result was not very good. But I did have an insight. I did have an insight, because when I really addressed this, you know, my feelings to Lungpa Cha, and you know, I thought he wasn't aware. I thought, Lungpa Cha doesn't know this. You know, he doesn't know what's going on. And I thought, I do and he doesn't. So I went to him one day and told him what had happened to his monastery. You know, it said it used to be a very good monastery. Not very good now. And he said, but that's the way it is. And that baffled me, because I thought, but it shouldn't be like this. You know, it's your responsibility to make it into what it was, because several years ago it was much better than this. Let's try to make it like it was, which I think was much better. But he wouldn't, you know, accept that. And he was just saying, this is the way it is. He was pointing to the way it is with me, or the way it is externally. But in this moment, this is the way it is. And that kind of openness and receptivity to the way it is, because I could actually, you know, see my own, recognize this feeling of my, you know, I didn't want it to be like this. I had an idea of what I wanted it to be. And I could see what I was doing. I was actually creating this conflict in my mind. And then in terms of a monastery, you know, one can idealize a monastery where, you know, all the monks are living in harmony and everything's fair and equal and they're all strict with the rules and everybody's practicing hard and nobody's, you know, taking advantage. Everybody's rowing together. This is the ideal, you know, one has of a Buddhist monastery. But that's not the way it is. Sometimes, at moments, it's like that, but to sustain that. Because, you know, with the Buddhist teachings, you're reflecting on the way things are, that each one of us is working out our karma in our own way. You know, and so, you know, the conceit of thinking that you should work out your karma like I do. You know, that's what I call conceit, isn't it? That I'm doing it the right way and you should do it exactly like I'm doing it. And yet, that kind of assumption was not uncommon in my early years. You know, wanting everybody to do it the way I do, or think that the way I'm doing it is the right way. And if they aren't doing it like that, then they should. And just observing this way of thinking, this way of this conceit, this arrogance, observing it, not even criticizing, it's not a fact of even criticizing arrogance, but recognizing the reality of conceit is like this. So that self-conceit and arrogance is then consciously seen rather than judged as something, you know, because ideally I don't want to be arrogant or conceited. You know, as an ideal, I don't want to, nobody, you know, the idea of an arrogant and conceited Buddhist monk is not attractive, you know. So we don't want to be arrogant and conceited. So when we're experiencing these mental states, then we can feel very guilty and feel very critical of ourselves, because we think, well, I'm too conceited and I'm too arrogant and I shouldn't be. But with awareness isn't a critical function of the mind. Awareness is not interested in the quality of anything, like if it's good or bad or pleasant or painful. It's aware of the way it is. It's discerning, its ability to know. It's like this, conditioned phenomena. That's why you're contemplating impermanence, because conditioned phenomena, whether it's pleasant or painful, right or wrong, gross or subtle, is its nature. It's always this flux and movement, this change. Learning to trust that awareness, then, is the way out of suffering, the way to recognize non-suffering. Now, to recognize non-suffering, then we think of, if, well, you have I still have a physical body, and then they say, do you still experience physical pain and hunger, and I have arthritic feet, you know, and I have I'm getting old, and I'm not so you know, supple anymore, and so that the body is then, you know, still is experiencing the problems of age, old age. But in terms of suffering, is that suffering? Is old age suffering? Is old, get up, an old body, is that a stiff body, our arthritic feet, is that suffering? Is that pain in my feet, is that suffering? Or what is the suffering? What is non-suffering if I still have pain in my feet? And then I can begin, just by reflecting, I begin to see the suffering the Buddha is pointing at in those noble truths is the suffering I create around the feet. The feet are what they are, you know, arthritic feet are like this and they feel like this, the way they are. And so it doesn't change the feet, you know, into not feeling pain. But it means that I stop creating a problem about it. I stop hating it or reacting against it or trying to, you know, always complain or worry or make it into some kind of problem for myself. It doesn't mean I don't try to, you know, relieve the pain if it's possible, but it doesn't preclude you from doing anything about it, but it's recognizing the difference between the way things are and what we are used to project onto the way it is. Now you even see, just like even naming something is a projection. You know, people, we tend to believe our definitions and our names for things more than the reality of the real thing. So we live in a world of ideas and perceptions, grasping these, and then our minds are conditioned to criticize and say this is better than that, and this is right and wrong, good and bad. That's the thinking faculty. That's the critical faculty. Like our rational mind is quite good at that. You know, it knows this is bigger and that's smaller, and this is better and that's worse, and this is right and this is wrong. Panya, or wisdom, the discerning ability, isn't critical. It's not saying how things should be or comparing one thing with another, but it's observing the way it is. It's an alert state, attention, fully with the present, with the pain in the feet. If I'm really with the pain in my foot, really with it, then I don't create suffering over that. I don't compound the actual experience with a desire to get rid of it. Apply that also just to emotional experiences. Emotional habits are very personal, aren't they? One's so used to identifying with emotions and judging emotional habits. And yet, awareness includes the emotion. Anger can arise. With awareness, you know anger is like this. Anger is something that arises and ceases. With awareness, it receives anger and discerns it, knows it's like this. It's not saying you should, Panya or wisdom isn't saying you should never be angry. Anger is bad, or you know, you're a bad monk because you're angry. But the wisdom faculty knows anger, what we call anger, this experience is like this. This is the way. So your relationship to it is fully receiving it, noticing, and not letting it be what it is, because its nature is to cease. So this reality of cessation is to be recognized, realized, and appreciated, so that we find our true nature is not, we're not conditioned, we're not the physical body, I'm not the body, or the emotional habits, or the thoughts or memories, emotions. These conditions arise, they become conscious due to conditions that make these things possible. But the refuge is in the awareness, this ability we all have to be fully present. So it's, I don't know how Ajahn Sajito feels right now, having this sense of completion of this beautiful building. I know at Amravati, when we had the celebration for the Amravati temple on July the 4th, 1999, suddenly I realized, I've actually finished something, it's finished. Amaravati's finished, and I've been so involved in building monasteries since the beginning, even when I was with Lumpo Cha, we were always building something. And then Wat Anacha, and then Chithurst, and Amaravati, and so there's always ongoing, thing of establishing and building and trying to improve. And so on July the 4th, 1999, it's this wonderful sense of it's finished. and then I thought, I'm not going to build anything more. It's finished. Now that period of my life, that chapter is over. It's just like something completed. And I didn't want to start another chapter with doing the same things that I did in the previous months. The sense of completion of this Dharma hall, because Chithurst, remember when we first came here, it was such a gorgeous setting that, you know, we were all mesmerized by the beautiful setting it's in. And we even, I think we, I even enjoyed the old derelict house. And when I have very happy memories of those 5 years I spent here, even though I wasn't happy all the time. But the memories are very, very positive. But then it always seemed like there was more to do, you know, the coach house and building the Dharma hall and then more kutis, and then we have the place for the nuns, and then we couldn't expand this anymore, so we had to find Amravati, and then we had to start over again there, and then build this, and we had to, you know, renovate, refurbish, and continuously ongoing meetings and around this kind of thing. And then the July the 4th, 1999 finished. And also it's like, even though it's just, you know, one can say, well, it's just on the material level, but also, you know, it's like it's something in me also finished at that moment. You know, the sense of something more to do, this habit of always seeing there's more to be done. I've got to do more. We have to do this, and we have to do that. And this is a kind of desire that it goes on and on and on. So when one gets caught into that as a monastic, you know, it one just is caught into this endless movement of going on and on. Contemplation of what suffering is and the causes of suffering and the cessation of suffering. The life of a monastic is getting to this simplicity of there isn't anything to do. You know, even practice doesn't make sense anymore. Because I became compulsive about practice. So compulsive about practice that if I, you know, sometimes I didn't want to practice. I was so fed up with it. Practice. Now I feel guilt, I should be practicing. And so in terms of awareness, this isn't a matter of even the word practice, it's a natural state. It's learning to relax and open. It's a natural state, it's not a cultivated, refined state that leads to the way of liberation. It leads to liberation. It's what Lungpo Chau called our real home. We're just returning, recognizing where we're at ease. Where we are, you know, your home is like a place you can totally be at ease. You're totally accepted. You totally belong in your home. And so our real home, is it Chittas, Dhammavati, or awareness? And the awareness, because sometimes, you know, conditions around change, monastic situations are, you know, an ongoing experience of change. People coming and going, ordaining, disrobing, praising and blaming, being inspired and being critical. But in terms of awareness, that's the refuge through that whole process of conditioned experience, which is the movement of the conditioned world. So, just offering this as a reflection for today, and to express my gratitude also for everybody involved in building this Dharma Hall, because it's truly beautiful, and it's better than I ever imagined it would be. And I've got a good imagination. So it is something to enjoy and to see as a place, not to just you know, see it in terms of aesthetics, but recognize a place of stillness. And I know like the Amaravati temple is a place that, you know, I see it as a place of stillness, even though stillness doesn't depend on a place. But yet, because it is, you know, it has, I've put that perception onto it, so that where, you know, when one goes in, you see, you just feel this sense of stillness, because it is, you know, in terms of a condition, as a convention, it's a place for stillness. So I recommend here, seeing this Dhamma hall, the place of stillness and awareness, of relaxation, of being at ease with yourself. Not a place where you've got to practice, and get rid of all your defilements, but as a place where you can open and open to life and be fully with the moment, because it has the ambience, the character that reminds us of that, that supports that. So congratulate Andrew and Nick Scott and Ajahn Sajipil. And everyone else that has helped make this possible, this building possible, in the English Sangha Trust and the Kunwani Lumsam, one of the great supporters. She's in Thailand now. She's was always encouraging and trying to find funds for supporting the development of both Amaravati and Chitthurst. And so there are many of these places have drawn from all over the world. The support, the generosity has come from all directions. And so this is also something quite beautiful. It isn't anybody's, you know, private monastery, or it's not, and one can't claim it in any way on a personal level, because it's a combined effort towards a skillful, with its skillful means, towards an end to help us all to trust in the Dhamma, to learn to trust ourselves, begin to recognize it's within us, it's learning to really appreciate your ability to be fully present in this moment, and to more you recognize and realize that, then you really see what the path is, the path of liberation, because it's merely that. It's nothing more complicated than that. So I offer this as a reflection.